Today's program is brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit culinarycenter.com.
This is Chef Emily Peterson, host of Sharp and Hot. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
So you don't shun the devil with your rock and roll, Lord. Knows that country music's gonna save your soul. The devil runs his groove in them rhythm and blues. That's him. It's gonna get you some.
Welcome back to The Speakeasy. I'm your host, Damon Bolte, and in the studio today, we've got my good old buddy Kevin Denton of Alder in New York City. Welcome back to the studio, brother.
Hey, it's great to be back, Damon. Thanks a lot for having me.
Heck yeah, man. Thanks for coming out here. It's always a good time hanging out with you, and it's always, you know, I've been thinking a lot about this lately, well, specifically this winter, because I can't really get over the fact that, like, it's another winter in New York, and it's like one of those times where you get kind of stir crazy, and I don't know, man, like, for me personally, like, when I'm coming up with cocktails and stuff, like, we have, like, this overall kind of thought here in New York where it's, like, there's, like, a lot of escapism, even though we're, like, it's, like, a very metropolitan kind of thing, you know, like, the overall vibe of the city, but, like, I think, like, what's been really cool lately is that, you know, as far as the, like, escapism with cocktails, there's been, like, you know, a lot of tiki stuff going on these days, especially in New York City, without an actual tiki bar, which is kind of an insanely interesting.
Oversight, maybe.
Yeah. But, like, I think there's, like, an overall, like, kind of, like, playful idea of these type of cocktails. And I've always liked your cocktails because you definitely, like, you do a lot of stuff that's, like, playful but, like, tongue-in-cheek, too. And, like, I know, like, especially when we start talking about, like, cocktail names, it's, like, some pretty ridiculous stuff. But it's always, like, really fucking awesome, balanced, forward-thinking cocktails. I mean, like, last time you were on the show, you guys were just opening Alder. And, and we talked quite a bit about that. And, like, how, like, I know that, like, your style of making cocktails, you've got, like, a heavy sense of classicism, but then you typically, like, push the envelope forward with a lot of. So how's the last, like, I guess it's been like a year and a half now that Alder's been open. How's the progress of that place coming along?
Well, you know, I think you make a really good point about the wintertime and the seasonal affect that kind of is a shroud that covers all of us in the wintertime, where you don't want to go out, but you live in New York City, so the FOMO hits pretty hard. So you drag yourself out through the muck, through the terrible weather, and then you find yourself in a position where you know, deep down you want to be convivial, but you also would much rather be binge-watching Quantum Leap for like 7 hours, you know, because he really is like the proto.
Show.
Yeah, he's like the proto David Duchovny. You know, he's a sex symbol, little like edgy, but you know, I think that it's been a really great year and a half. It's been bittersweet to send off WD-50. Bitter in the fact that it very much is the end of an era of a place that allowed people without much thought to. You know, the bottom line, to really explore and be creative, do whatever it is they want. If you want to figure something out, do it 1,000 times, and if you dump it down the drain 999 times, that was okay. And to have a boss like that was truly a blessing, truly a once-in-a-lifetime sort of engagement. At Alder, you know, we have a good combination of being a destination of people that are coming specifically to eat Wiley's food, but also it's in the East Village on a pretty.
You got some pretty good like traffic, you know, like as far as like foot traffic goes.
Yeah, it's.
I think more so than WD-50, right?
Without a doubt, Clinton Street, you know, was it's changed significantly, you mm-hmm. know, since I moved to New York 10 years ago. That was sort of, St. Jerome was kind of the hinterlands of where I would explore in 2003, 2004. But now, you know, apparently we need luxury condominiums on Clinton Street. So the times are changing. And, you know, the block that we exist on in with Alder is a little desolate, having like the 13th Step and some of those like college-y rump shaker bars. Not that there's anything wrong with it, but it definitely makes some of the walk-through traffic interesting. But we do have some phenomenal regulars and phenomenal neighbors that come in, and we're able to give you that Cheers vibe where, like, when you come in, I know what you're drinking. I know, you know, what's been going on in your life. And that's some of the best parts of bartending. That's why I've been doing it for so long, because I love that convivial, familiar spirit that exists when you come back to the same place all the time. But we also give you that added flair of we're always kind of pushing and doing something a little bit different. I kind of have always tried to approach my menus like, I don't want to say that I do it strictly seasonally, but like, you know, I'll make a big change and I kind of try to do it like Neil Young records. Like, you know, everyone's going to be a little bit different. One might be a complete flop. You know, some of them are going to appeal to certain people and not to other people, but they've got something that's familiar about all of them. And then insofar as like cocktail naming, I think that's probably the hardest part, but it's also that's the hook, right? You know, before you even see it, before you know what's going on, you're reading something. And because I use a lot of weirdo ingredients, you may not know what all those things are, but if it's a funny tongue-in-cheek name or something that's kind of clever or offbeat, then at least, you know, it's baited the hook a little bit and you might be more inclined to ask about it. Yeah. So,
I mean, like, I think that, like, well, first of all, like, well, with Alder, it's like, my thing is, like, I don't like dark bars.
Yeah.
I mean, like, well, there's time for it, you know, but, like, I like natural light, and you guys have like the big windows in the front and the bars right there behind those front windows. So it does give it more of like a more welcoming kind of vibe, you know? And like you said, like kind of a Cheers vibe, you know, what's cool about that too, is like, to me, it's like, you know, you've got you've got like a pretty like extremely hardcore like cocktail program going on, but at the same time, you don't want it to be like exclusive. You want it to be in like, impressive and important, I guess, to a certain level, but at the same time, you don't want it to be totally exclusive to where you're like kind of like kicking people out of the vibe. And like you were saying, like, you use a lot of weirdo ingredients, like, and especially like when you go back to that Cheers vibe, like, do you find that like when you change menus, do you have people come in and order cocktails from like previous menus?
I don't want to blow a spot up too much, but one of our big regulars, who's just fantastic, is Aaron Neville, and it's cool. It's so like Richard Hell and Aaron Neville come in with some regularity, and I guess pick two people to be regulars, that's pretty awesome.
That's such a cool duo.
Weirdo combo, right? So I keep he loved the Burnt Reynolds, which is a Boulevardier with smoked vermouth. And so I just keep it for him, you know, and I like have a batch made. And then a lot of the pantry items that were part of previous drinks, I just kind of keep in my back pocket and clutter stuff up with. But when those people come back and ask for it, you know, barring, you know, the really seasonal stuff, like if it's good fruit or things that only happen in the summertime, obviously I'm not going to keep that stuff around. I'm not going to use it if it's from Riviera or whatever. But being able to recreate those things for people that it obviously had an impact on them, that's something that I'm happy to do and inclined to do. At the same time, as soon as people get too comfortable with something, that's when I want to change it.
Sure.
Because it's obviously time to shake things up and to do something a little differently.
Or stir them.
Again. That sweet bartender humor. And you know, there is something to be said, you know, back to your original point about when you're in the doldrums like this, when, you know, you're in Smarch, which, you know, is like, to me, the deepest, darkest, most depressing month.
Sure.
You know, you have to find a way to appeal to that hope that, you know, spring is around the corner, mm-hmm. even though the ingredients aren't that great right now. You know, you're not getting fresh stuff. You're not getting stuff that's really...
You can only put beets in too many cocktails.
Yeah, you know. But you do have some, you know, some good citrus has a little bit of life left, which is bright and refreshing. You have some herbs that you can use year-round that you can grow inside, so you can start to reintroduce. I think spring is probably the most difficult month, or difficult season to sort of play to, because you haven't, like, nothing is really growing yet.
You haven't experienced it, but there's the anticipation of it.
Yeah, and you want it. You just want it so bad after all this. And we've, you know, we've had a couple winters in a row here in New York that have just been brutal. So, you know, I've got a couple things going on in the next week or so that I think are going to appeal to that are, some are a little more familiar, and then one that's going to be, real far out.
Cool, man.
Yeah.
I love far out.
Yeah.
So speaking of far out, you know, like the, like you're saying, you know, like when you're coming up with like a cocktail name and a recipe, I mean, like, you and I are both musicians, and I know that in the past we've talked about coming up with recipes and the influence of, like, just having a really solid name. You know, even if it's something that's funny and, like, quirky and tongue-in-cheek, or, like, a pun on something, like the Burnt Reynolds, you know,
right.
Something like that. Like, you still, like, pull quotes and titles and album names from the music world to inspire the cocktails, right?
Oh, without a doubt. And you know, Phil Ward, who, you know, we both know and is a great influence, and he was a great mentor of mine when he was when I was working at MyOL, he always talked about when he was stumped for a name, he would just go to the bookshelf,
yeah,
and just start scrolling through and picking from there. And I think that there is great value in that, because it relates back to a story, you know, or it relates back to a time and a place. And then getting really meta, you know, when you're referencing old cocktails, like when you're revamping classics, or you're putting your own spin on it, taking whatever that name is and tweaking that a little bit. You know, we've got one of our most popular drinks right now is called Suffering Fools. Which is a subversive way for me to sort of, you know, it's the crowd pleaser. It's a riff on a suffering mm-hmm. bastard.
Sure.
And, like, who doesn't like whiskey and ginger?
Right.
And nobody's necessarily going to get the suffering bastard reference other than bar people. But it is like a little subversive.
You can say nerds.
Well, yeah.
I'm kidding.
Yeah. And, you know, it's for the nerds to say, like, oh, well, this is like our little joke,
yeah,
you know, about what this is, you know, and you know, hopefully the guest gets a laugh out of it too. It falls on deaf ears many times, but, you know, you have to keep yourself entertained.
Yeah. Do you ever speaking of like writing recipes based on like song titles or albums or bands or, you know, whatever, do you ever find yourself as a musician, like, when you're, like, hanging around, like, playing those songs, do you ever, like, does it ever work, like, in reverse, where, like, you're, like, say you're playing, you know, like, Tumbling Dice by the Rolling Stones, and you have a Tumbling Dice cocktail, just for an example, like, does it ever make you want to drink that cocktail?
Well, so, yes, and
when you're not, like, busy singing into a microphone.
I, on my last record, I have a tune called Campari and Soda.
Yeah.
That you guys, you know, can put in the rotation anytime you want. Full permission.
You hear that, Jack?
Yeah. but that was one, like, there's few times where, other than, like, the white guy blues stuff where they talk, you know, reference the whiskey and you know, one bourbon, one scotch, one beer. Like, you know, those are general things. But I think, you know, if writing songs is about speaking about your life, you know, and being confessional about what's going on, like, I want to be straightforward about, you know, this is what I drink. You know, like when the chartreuse song happens, it's going to be a big old sloppy mess, but it's going to have, you know, I think it'll be like a John Cale song, because I would imagine that would be, if I drink chartreuse, I think, oh, John Cale would probably have this, you know, it's right. Like Paris 1919. And
I mean, I always have a Fireball and Diet Coke when I play my own song, Fireball and Diet Coke. Yeah. So I get it, man.
And I think that there's...
And I'm just trying to be honest, you know.
As well you should, you know. And I think that there's merit in, you know, what's really struck me about this industry and about the genesis of drinking culture that's, you know, cocktail-driven, that is redefining what it is to drink socially, to drink as a lifestyle. You know, we are diving into this minutia, into these old spirits, into these like weird things, into these arcane mixtures. And if you can start to bring that into the culture a little bit beyond just having a conversation across the bar, it's like I'm writing about it. I'm, you know, making music about it. I'm bringing it more into the fore. Like if I read old books and people are talking about having a Dubonnet, then I immediately know what that is and I can relate to it. If I hear a song and someone's talking about, you know, we were drinking absinthe, and if they mention one specifically, then that's the light's going to go off and I'm going to say, I can relate to that. I know what that person is talking about.
Sure. It's
and,
like when Hemingway talks about drinking like Fin Low, you know, it's like, dude, really? You guys are just hanging out drinking brandy and water all day? Yeah. It's awesome.
Right.
but it's a time and a place and an occasion, and it's like kind of like intertwined with the day in, day out, kind of like the unofficial schedule, you know?
Sure. And like we were talking about Kingsley Amis before, like there was a you know, maybe they're anti-heroes, maybe they're rapscallions, maybe they're a little less than desirable characters, but I think a lot of us, you and I included, gravitate towards those characters. And because they are making good art and they're making powerful statements or they're making great observations, and they do so in the context of what they were eating and drinking in a specific way, then if you care about those things, all of a sudden it gives that much more texture and that much more color.
Yeah, and I think that you're absolutely right. You know, like, I feel like food and drinks are just, they're kind of like the most important thing in life. You know, like, the very first industry job that I had, I've kind of recounted this probably too many times, but the first chef that I ever heard say anything extremely, to me at least, profound about, like, the industry, or just, like, the contents in the context of what it is, he said, the most romantic thing you can do with another person is share a meal. And I don't know, it resonated with me very hardcore. And I always say that, like, the two nicest things you can do for another human being is cook for them and listen to them. And, you know, I think there's a lot of, I don't know, it's just life. It's like, first of all, it's sustenance, you know, like, well, yeah. The food side anyway.
That's but easy, like, to relate to.
Yeah, but like, but the drink side is, that's kind of like, there's like the living part, like the life preservation part, and then the living life. I don't think there's any like more profound moment than you can have with a person outside of like being born or dying than like having a drink with someone.
Or being intimate with them.
Well, sure. I mean, like, yeah, but that's, I do that all the time with everyone.
Lucky.
All right, we're getting weird.
No, well, I think that the point to be made to amplify that statement is we've seen an arc of development in the drinking culture where it was something that everybody did all the time for a long time. and it was very rich, and it was vast, and it was part of the culture. And then you had these dark ages for a few decades where things became freeze-dried and sort of pushed in, I would say pushed into the darkness, where yeah. it was not about community. It wasn't about conviviality. It wasn't something that could be celebrated. It was something that was, you know, maybe a little fratty, maybe a little dark. You know, I blame the excesses of the 70s and early 80s that really made these things less desirable. And here you have a moment in time where we're starting to rediscover the joys of these things, where it isn't necessarily tied to excess. It isn't necessarily tied to destruction. It can actually come back into the light a little bit.
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, man. Like the excesses and also just like the irresponsibility of it. I think if you're living in that kind of lifestyle and if you're doing things responsibly, like I'm doing air quotes for the listeners out there, I think it's totally a passable thing. Like, you know, when you hear about like so you go to Germany and you have like a Weisswurst in the morning and a Hefeweizen, totally normal, man.
Right.
But it's like, but you didn't have three of them. You had like, you know, not even a half liter. You had like a 300 milliliter glass of Hefeweizen along with your vice versa, and you go about your day. You know?
And living in Europe was, I don't want to sound like one of those people that's like, oh, in Europe they do it all better, but there was something to be said about...
We just fucked up, man. We fucked up bad.
We screwed it up. And like, hopefully we can get back to the point where you can enjoy something like that. You can enjoy a glass of wine with lunch, and no one's going to bat an eye at you because you pick that wine because you love it, you enjoy it, you might know something about it, you're happy about it, and it's going to be a great compliment to it.
Yeah.
I don't think that... I think that it is a sign of sophistication if you do care about what you're putting in yourself, you know, and whether it's, you know, stigmatized as, oh, why are you drinking it at noon? It's like, well, I may be having a glass of wine, but I'm also having food that I care how it was prepared. I'm spending the money because I know this person cares about what's going into it. And I'm having this beverage because it's a great compliment to it. And
that's the bigger overall picture. You know, it's like, it's, I think I love that. I love the idea of that. Like when the food and the beverage go well together, and there's just the right amount. It doesn't have to be like completely going overboard with it. It's like these should go together.
And then you have fun, and like, you know, who's not in a better mood after they have a glass of wine? You know,
I don't know. I mean, seems
sure,
pretty
somebody.
Cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, dude, okay, so this morning I had a film shoot at Prime Meats, mm-hmm. and we were doing a shoot. Basically, it's for Condé Nast Traveler. Matt Hranick, awesome, awesome guy. He was shooting this thing, and he's doing a series of these classic cocktails, but like modern riffs on them. So mm-hmm. we did the Prime Manhattan, which is the Manhattan that we have for Prime Meats. Mm-hmm. And the real difference about it is that I make a bitters out of Buddha's hand, and I use a lemon twist on it because it's kind of like more citrus-driven classic Manhattan. It's 2-1, a few dashes of the Buddha's hand bitters that I make. And I mean, I didn't have one, but he was like, "Nah, let's shoot that again," you know. Like, so I had to make a few of them. But we had lunch after that, and we had some steaks, and I was like, "Dude, let's have some of the Frankie's." Like, we've got this Valpolicella that we started having produced for us, you know, and like the bottle was never emptied.
Yeah,
you know, and that's a good sign. For lunch, I guess. Yeah. But like, it was like, all right, we're just having this wine and we're tasting it to go with the food, with these steaks. And it was perfect. And no one necessarily like even got to the bottom of their glasses. And it wasn't, so it's not about like actually like drinking this for the effect. It's about like the actual pairing. I love that.
Yeah. And you know, I would rather have that than a Diet Coke, you know?
Well, yeah.
I think there is a tremendous merit in understanding the context of what you're drinking and when. and why and where, you know. And I think that, you know, if I was to ever do a book, it would be a field guide to what to drink, where, when, and how. Because, you know, whenever someone says, what should I drink? You know, it's one of those questions that I hear 100 times every day. And the question I always follow with is, well, how are you feeling? Like, where are you at in your day?
Yeah, sure.
You know, like, if you're about to, you know, go break up with your girlfriend, something different. If you're about to go on, you know, a celebratory binge, if you're in a contemplative place, if you have to go home and do some work, if you're, like, it's all situational. And situational understanding allows guys like you and I to be better at our jobs, because we have a sense for, here's where you're at. We know all the stuff behind us. We picked it. We purchased it. We've worked with it. We've tasted it. We've thought about it. We've learned about it, you know, to some of us to great lengths, you know. And I think that that is overlooked in our industry, is we've got a lot of these, you know, as you say, nerds that go really deep in understanding a lot of products. And they have this broad palette and this broad spectrum of understanding of things that they can sort of prescribe to you for the right situation. And it's, we would be remiss as an industry to not engage someone in, where are you at? What do you like? I'm not drinking, so stop asking me, well, what do you like? Because I'm going to say, I like this, and you're going to say...
You're going to say, why are you buying me a drink?
Yeah.
Yeah, doesn't matter what I like to drink.
Yeah, you're paying for it, so... Yeah. And, you know, I understand that...
Because I drink Fireball and Diet Coke.
Yeah, and I will never understand that, but...
I'm kidding. So, okay, well, on that note, like, what's... just what's your like go to? I mean, like, you know, I know that you and I and a lot of tons of people like us who work in the industry or who are just like interested enthusiasts, you know, we all kind of have like our go to drink, right? Mm-hmm. And I know it changes, like you're saying, like situationally. Like I know that like when I get off work from a long shift, I don't necessarily. Maybe I don't want a cocktail. Maybe I don't want a glass of wine. Maybe I just want a beer. Whatever. But mm-hmm. that does change. What's your go-to?
Mezcal.
Yeah?
Yeah, easily. I think it's the most dynamic category. I think that it will be to our generation, or to the generation that's coming up and drinking now, what malt whiskey was to previous generations.
Interesting.
I think that the category is becoming more and more diverse. There's a lot to take in. And honestly, it's kind of expensive. So the good stuff is pricey. So you have these like banker types that want to show off that they're spending some money. I find that the way that mezcal makes me feel is like positive and up, whereas if I'm drinking malt whiskey, it mellows me. And I think that you take the connotation of someone who was drinking tequila in college to get crazy, and, you know, they've matured and they've come, you know, a long way from that. They still like the way that the tequila made them feel, but, you know, they're out on their expense account and they want to try something different.
Right.
And the category is, again, it's so diverse and no two mezcals are alike. I think it, and there's a barrier to entry, which I also kind of like, you know, someone's not going to have that first sip of mezcal and say, oh, I love this, you know, give me more of this. They're going to say, it's smoky. And like, I hardly taste the smoke anymore because now it's, wow, this is selenic. Wow.
Very
this
deep.
Is, it's, if you want to get contemplative about a spirit, I think that's an easy one to go real deep into. And I also like that, you know, you have a little, like, half-ounce copita of it every once in a while.
I totally agree. And I love the ritual of drinking mezcal, too. I think that most drinks, most tipples that you will have, there should be kind of, like, a way to drink it. And I think that's important, too. It's not, like... just being a booze hound and like slugging whatever.
Slugging them, yeah.
But the ritual of drinking mezcal is really, really cool. Having the little terracotta, like copitas, and just like knowing the history of like all the single villages and like it's really cool. I'm glad that you said that because actually was it last week, Jack? We had Jamie Salas, is it Jaime or Jamie from Milagro. And we were talking about, like you were saying, that it's an expensive category, but it's actually not. I mean, like, when you think about it, it's like, and he was saying that you see, like, value and age for, like, spirits like whiskeys and brandies, and you see, like, all the age happens after they're produced.
Right.
But the production of agave-based spirits, tequilas, mezcals, it's all in growing the plant for, sure, like, a decade. You know? So I get it, man. I respect that side of the cost, you know? But I think it's you're definitely right. I think it's really cool. It's one of the spirit categories I'm most excited about, too. What about cocktails? Like, as far as, like, I mean, like, of course, like, going for the straight spirit after a nice shift is really good. But, like, what's your, like, go-to cocktail?
Like everybody else in the industry right now, I love daiquiris. I really fell in love with Flor de Caña daiquiris when I was in Nicaragua. I think because that country was on the U.S. shit list for those dark days, they never had the powdered sour mix and all the other stuff that infected the Caribbean and made drinks culture there suck so badly.
Yeah.
So when I was traveling around the country, going to hotel bars and other, like, even just like small divey spots, like, everybody was using fresh juice. They had, you know, most of the bartenders that were there were guys in their, you know, 40s and 50s that had been doing it forever. And they weren't necessarily jiggering. They weren't necessarily... They just had the experience of doing it for so long that they were making delicious drinks.
It's like jazz, dude. It was all instinct.
Yeah. And they never lost the tradition the way that other places. Like, you go to, what is the place in Old San Juan where the piña colada was invented?
I can't remember right now.
You go to a lot of it, or you go to Hotel Monteleone, you know, 10 years ago, and like the place where these eponymous drinks were created, and they like just managed to suck it up now and like mass produce it, and it's just not great. Having a tradition that sort of weathered the storm was really great, and I think the rum is delicious, and you know, whether or not it's good for the country or whatever. You know, you see Flor de Caña signs everywhere, and it's cheaper to buy a bottle of rum than it is to buy a Coke. So, but I do like that because it's
or a Diet Coke
or a Diet Coke and Fireball. At least he didn't say Diet Coke and vodka because that's a special kind of
that
hell.
Is a thing. Yeah,
I very much enjoying Negronis. I used to live in Tuscany for a little while, and I had a very Napoleonic hotel owner that I worked for that forced those down my throat. And I was like, why do you like Negronis and Grappa and Amaro? And I'm like, you people like this stuff? You know, the first couple of times is so gross. But again, it's that barrier to entry again. It's like you graduate into the club and then you're like, now I get it. Like this was a little more difficult, and that's why you gain that appreciation for it. I think that there is a lot of continuity in what people in our industry gravitate towards because it's some of the best stuff. I love a margarita. The whole country loves a margarita. Mm-hmm. I make it a rule whenever I go to any restaurant or bar that I order off their list because I know someone put the time and effort into coming up with those things, and far be it from me to say, well, I'm just going to have this thing I can get anywhere. Like, you're missing the point, and you're being short-sighted in the way that you're approaching someone else's craft.
Yeah.
So, you know, does that mean that I have some less awesome drinks every once in a while? Sure, but, like, everybody's trying, you know? Like, there's...
Hell, and it's a hell of a lot cooler than it was 15 years ago.
Without a
doubt. 10 years ago, 5 years ago, whatever.
And you don't have to like everything, you know? And someone may love that, and it may be something that they're excited about. Like, there are certainly a bunch of duds that I've put on menus in the past that I've thought, well, this is cool. And like, you know, when the one person comes in is like, hey, do you guys still make that Mingus cocktail? And I'm like, you might be the one person on the planet that like that. So, nice. You know, but again, when I'm at home, I think I drink aged rum quite a bit. When I am going out to bars, then again, I'll try a cocktail, but I'll have a little mezcal sidecar because mm-hmm. that makes me happy. I very much enjoy drinking weirdo wine. I like sherry. I like it all. And I think as it's sort of my responsibility being a professional in this business to just try it all.
Of course. Well, you have to taste everything. That's for sure.
It's a hard job.
Yeah. Real tough. Well, you know what? It's been really tough talking with you today, which is totally not anything I would ever say ever. You know, normally on this show, we take a break halfway through.
No breaks.
We did not take a break today because it's so great to have you in the studio. We burned right through it. Unfortunately, we've run out of time today, but God damn it, Kevin. It's great to have you in the studio. You're an awesome dude, and can't wait to come see you at Alder. Oh, you're doing a benefit for Black Crescent tomorrow, right?
Yeah, if we could throw a little plug in there. We had good friends of ours had their bar burned down, had a terrible electrical fire last month. So my band and another couple great bands are going to be playing at pianos at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening. There's going to be confetti cannons. There's going to be costume changes. It's going to be the greatest night of anyone's life. So if you can come down, it's only $12, and it's a very good cause.
At pianos tomorrow night.
7 o'clock.
Cool. And the band is the Crooners.
It's actually Denton. It's my solo act.
So. Oh, you're doing the cool,
yeah,
man.
Yeah, you're going to
cool.
hear Campari and Soda right off the bat.
Righteous, man. Well, thanks again for coming into the studio today. It's always a pleasure to have you here. And go check out Kevin at Alder in New York City. And thanks again for coming, man.
Thank you very much.
All right. Till next week, check out heritageradionetwork.org for many other programs like this. Until then, cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us with questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.